welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, coming to you live from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and Sudan this Wednesday, August 28, 2024. The South Sudan Doctors Union says the country has 500 national doctors offering services in 10 states and 3 administrative areas.
South Sudan is a new country in the world, having a very few number of doctors. We have medical officers, some specialists, and then sub-specialty doctors. But in general, the number is very few.
And health workers strike, bite patients at Bor Hospital.
No one is attending to us. And even going outside is very difficult because when you don't have money to go to the clinic, you cannot go outside. We are just seated like that. Tell the government to talk to them and pay them.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Patients at Bor State Hospital say lives of their loved ones are at risk after medical staff went on strike last week. Some patients say they have not received medical attention from nurses over the past 7 days. For VOA News, Mamer Abraham Kwart reports from Malakal.
The staff at Bor Hospital are staying home. They are protesting delays in processing their incentives for the month of July. The action of the health workers has affected several patients who say they have been stranded at the hospital without services. 30-year-old Lachol Mayom, a mother of 3 children, says the state government should pay medical staff at the hospital so children can receive treatment.
She was admitted on Monday, and from that day up to today, no one is attending to us. And even going outside is very difficult because when you don't have money to go to the clinic, you cannot go outside. We are just seated like that. Tell the government to talk to them and pay them their salaries so that they can come back.
Michael Lemkor, a registered midwife working at Bor State Hospital, says he has been forced to do other work while waiting for his July payment.
It's better that you go and burn your shackles or you go and work in a clinic where you will be paid something very small that you will feed your family. Like for me here, I used to come here and work, and the other relatives are the one helping me.
Mabior Madit Mabior, a clinical officer at Bor State Hospital who decided to go to work, says he and a few other health workers are managing critical cases.
Those who are in the ward in a critical condition, we manage them. But the new cases, we are not managing them. Those are patients that are now in the ward, those who are in critical, those of wounded and inpatient ward, and those in labor ward, those who are in critical, in maternity, they are there. So, but those who have been just a little bit, we discharge them.
The Director General at the State Ministry of Health did not answer several calls for comment on the strike and the conditions of the patients at the hospital. For VOA News, I am Mayor Abraham Kwart, reporting from Upper Nile State's capital, Malakal.
Still on health matters, the chairperson of the South Sudan Doctors Union says the country has few doctors working in various government health centers across the country. Dr. Anwar Zakaria says the union has registered 500 doctors who are offering services in the 10 states and 3 administrative areas of South Sudan. He says the government of South Sudan should increase the budget of the National Health Ministry from 2% to 20%.
Currently, the national budget to fund the health system in the country is very low. This has been our advocacy to the national government through the parliament, because in every year before approval of any financial budget for the country, they call South Sudan Doctors Union to be part of the public hearing of the budget. And we have been advocating through that meeting to increase the budget for the health from the 2%, about 2%, to 15%.
We are getting a report from Mvolo County in Western Equatorial State, where residents of the county are calling on the national and state ministries to send a doctor to the area because, according to the residents, they have no doctor and most of their loved ones are dying as they
walk. In the country, South Sudan is a new country in the world, having a very few number of doctors. We have medical officers, some specialists, and then sub-specialty doctors. But in general, the number is very few compared to the population of the South Sudan and then the vast area of the country. We have some good number of medical officers. In general, we have around 500 doctors in the South Sudan, according to our statistic of the South Sudan Doctors Union. But when you look at the country is huge, it's big in geographically, and some areas which are not covered with the proper health infrastructure, that we say the secondary health level. We only have secondary health levels at the level of the state. But when you go down to the counties, when from county you go to the Fayam, there's a lack of this high level of health care services.
How many medical schools are there in the country training and, if you like, producing doctors for the population? I mean, 500 doctors per a population of like 11 million, that's like a drop of water in the desert.
Yeah, currently we have three government medical schools in the country. That is Juba University, Kwazulu University, and then Upper Nile University. But in addition to that, we have some of our students, they go outside the country abroad to obtain this medical study. Currently, the government of Ethiopia, they are supporting us on every year, sending some of our students to universities in Ethiopia. Also, Kenya, Uganda, modern countries are supporting us in graduating some numbers of medical students.
Talk to me about how much a doctor is paid in South Sudan. I mean, I'm talking of a doctor who is working at a government hospital. How much is he or she paid per month?
Currently, the doctors under the Ministry of Health, if it is national or state level, the payment is very, very little compared to the living cost. In the country, we have inflation this time around. For example, the Boys State Hospital doctor, they are expecting about the payment of around 700 USD per month. So we are not having enough support in terms of the human resource for health. Most of the time, it is the donors and then some other organizations that are funding the health.
What is the Doctors Union doing, the South Sudan Doctors Union doing to address these challenges, ranging from low pay, very few number of doctors, and, dependence on aid organizations to supplement the work of the state and health ministries? What is the union doing to mitigate these challenges?
Yeah, union is a non-profit, non-governmental body. For us, we use advocacy to raising our voice to the government in the official channels. For example, as I told you, in any public hearing for financial budget, we participate in that meeting and we raise our voice. And also, in terms of some big donors, when they call us for some orientation meeting, we also raise our voice through those channels.
That's Dr. Anwar Zakaria, chairperson of the South Sudan Doctors Union. The union is calling on the National Ministry of Health to increase the budget of the ministry from 2% to 15%. He spoke with me via phone from South Sudan earlier today. We apologize for that poor quality of the phone line from Zain Company. Survivors of a flood following a dam breach in eastern Sudan are appealing for assistance from local government to rescue hundreds of people who remain missing and to secure alternative water sources for those affected. Emergency responders are scrambling to determine the number of people still missing after the collapse of the Arbat Dam in Red Sea on Sunday. Here's Philip Alexio with more.
Representatives of international organizations visited the area Tuesday of Sudan's collapsed Arbat Dam to assess damage at the less affected side of the dam in eastern Sudan, which collapsed earlier this week due to heavy flooding. but the team struggled to reach the other side as roads were closed. Emergency responders were scrambling on Tuesday to find out how many people remained missing after waters burst through the dam, resulting in the worst in a series of floods that have devastated a country already torn by 500 days of war.
Arba is known for the dam providing water to the entire Red Sea state, and may God help us to serve the citizens of the Red Sea state. We delivered humanitarian assistance from the first day of the floods, and it shall continue until God saves the people. Today, while preparing our reports with the people, we knew that people have lost their homes, farms, cattle, and everything.
The governor of the Red Sea state, Mustafa Muhammad Noor, was thankful to God that 171 citizens have been saved and said work will continue to save more people. One survivor of Arabat is resident Muhammad Sharif.
We have a missing body that we could not find for 4 days. And we have families who are struggling to deliver food to on the other side of the collapsed dam. There are dead bodies that were swept away by floods. We cannot reach the Red Crescent or any organization to go to the affected area on the other side. We cannot do anything.
30 people have died as a result of the dam breach, and it's likely there will be more victims to be found. War-shattered Sudan is already suffering from the world's largest hunger and displacement crisis, and the flooding has impeded aid delivery already disrupted by the conflict between the army and its rival, the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. Philip Alexio, VOA News.
Still on Sudan, the World Food Program is investigating two of its top officials in Sudan. 11 people with knowledge of the probe told Reuters that the officials are accused of fraud and concealing information from donors about its ability to deliver food aid to civilians amid the nation's hunger crisis. As part of the probe by the WFP's Office of Inspector General, investigators are looking at whether staff sought to hide the alleged role of Sudan's army in obstructing aid amid a brutal 16-month conflict with rival paramilitary for control of the country. In recent years, its operations have been rocked by division and theft of aid in countries including Somalia, Yemen. The WFP and USAID last year temporarily suspended food distribution in Ethiopia following reports of widespread stealing of food aid there. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, food demands is creating opportunities in Africa. Find out how. After the break.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. Send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Our words of wisdom for this Wednesday comes from Central Equatorial State.
My name is called Igaga Zura. I'm from Yare Village, Yare River County. We have a proverb in Kakwa which says, Kotomata, Matinekinye Jina, Uki Ipiokatayo, Kagoro Kineponda, Yoga Na Saresikilo Ipiokatayo. Means that if the leadership of the crocodile fail in the river, the crabs will come and disorganize the system in the river. Thank you very much.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Food demands is creating substantial opportunities for Africa's food processing. That's according to the report of Malabo Panel. It says the rise in population, urbanization, and middle class incomes in Africa is creating marketable opportunities for processed foods. However, a report by Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, indicates that millions of people across the continent still suffer from food shortage. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Sacramento.
The latest report by the Malabo Mompilia Panel, a group of international agriculture experts who support policies that accelerate food and nutritional security in Africa, indicates that population growth will encourage food processing companies to produce food and jobs. The panel says policy innovations in the sector offer African governments a framework to adopt policies that will increase food production. Aisha Salah is the co-chair of Malabo Mompilia Forum.
Food processing is one of the most important pathways for improving the nutrition status of many population groups across Africa and boosting the agri-food systems and beyond the economy development at large. Assuming, of course, that food safety requirements are rigorously respected and controlled by the relevant authorities across the value chain.
Africa's population is projected to grow by 2.5% annually from 1.2 billion in 2016 to 2.4 billion people by 2050. The continent's urban population is also expected to increase from 43% in 2020 to 60% by 2050, with the middle class making up to 42% of the population by 2060. Salah says African countries should take advantage of changes in market demand instead of relying on food imports.
The continent has been engaged in the traditional processing of foods since the past decades. However, the rising demands of processed foods call for increased adoption of advanced technologies to enhance the production of these products. These could contribute to reducing the dependency on imports to the continent.
The food processing sector faces many challenges ranging from environmental factors like climate change and water shortages, as well as structural constraints related to improving infrastructure and profitability. Josepha Sako, the head of Agriculture, Rural Development, Blue Economy and Sustainable Environment at the African Union Commission, says Africa has had the highest agricultural growth in the past two decades despite its challenges.
20 years of implementation of CADEP has seen an increase in Africa's gross domestic product, our GDP. Although we could have done more, but at least this instrument is really helping us to shape the way of the transformation of agriculture on the continent. So the progress has, however, been slower than anticipated due to immense challenges and shocks such as the climate change and global economic disruption.
At the same time, the Deputy Executive Secretary of the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, Mohamed Ware, says food production is still limited to economic shocks, local currency depreciation, low foreign currency reserves, a high public debt burden, and volatile food prices.
While eradicating hunger is an achievable goal, it requires a fundamental shift in our approaches. There is an urgent need for proactive collaboration to implement sustainable solutions and strengthen our resilience mechanisms against the impact of climate change and conflict.
The 14th meeting of the Malabo Mompilia Forum calls on governments and other stakeholders to collaborate and implement strategies that promote the production of healthy, safe, nutritious, and high-quality processed foods. For VOA Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in San Francisco.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. And now for some sports news. 24-year-old Ide Umarao Jibaro says he always dreamed of one day carving out his path to the Paris 2024 Paralympics Games, which opened today, and his amputated left arm was not an obstacle. VOA Africa reporter Berema Balima has the young athlete's story from Niamey, Niger, narrated by Omari Kaseko.
Ide Omaro Jabiroz grew up mimicking other martial arts athletes, but never imagined practicing martial arts like most young boys his age. He still believed in his heart that one day he will carve out his own path to the Paralympic Games. Now he's looking forward to participating in this year's Paris 2024 Paralympic Games, taking place from August 28 to September 8 in Paris. Jabiro says he believed his grandfather, who kept telling him to not see his amputated left arm as an obstacle. Jabiro says he didn't think he could do it because of his disability, but his grandfather, a taekwondo enthusiast, encouraged him.
When I was little, I liked playing football. It's football that I like the most. When I competed for the first time outside, it was in Turkey. People thought I was there because of football. Now, it's taekwondo that has taken over.
His mother's uncle, Mahamadou Sole, who Jabiro refers to as his grandfather, says he saw something special in him. His grandfather, Mamadou Sole, says ever since Jabiro was little, he knew that he was going to achieve something great, and he never hesitated to tell him that. The 24-year-old athlete has already made history as the first Paralympic athlete from Niger to compete in para-taekwondo, which debuted as a Paralympic game in Tokyo 2020. He attributes his success to his grandfather, who was his first coach. He calls him Papa Cho, a reference to Niger's Olympic coach, Grandmaster Hyong Ko Cho. Jabiro says he was 20 years old when he first started training, and his first coach was his grandfather, Mohamedou Sole. Sole would spend hours with Jabiro every day, teaching him the right techniques.
There are many people who helped me get to this point. The first person is Papa Cho, the first one who encouraged me to do taekwondo, and my two coaches.
His father, Ide Omaro, says Jabiro's discipline is remarkable. Jabiro's father, Ide Omaro, says he's confident that Ide will excel because he has worked hard to reach this level, alongside studying as a second-year agronomy student at Abdou Momoni University in Niamey. Jabiro's coach, Abdurrahman Isaka Yao, says he qualified in the K44 men's 70-kilogram category, which includes athletes with unilateral arm amputation or equivalent loss of function or loss of toes. The disability affects the ability to lift the heel properly. But Jabiro is not letting his disability limit him. His coach, Abdurrahmane Isaka Yao, says he has high hopes that Jabiro will return triumphant. Jabiro says he couldn't contain his excitement the moment he realized he could take his dream to the world stage. Jabiro says the day he found out he qualified for the Olympics was one of the happiest days of his life, but that he also realized he had a big responsibility toward his family and his country. Back home in Niger, Jabiro's family checks on him daily, keeping his spirits up as he prepares to compete and challenge perceptions about differently abled athletes. Jabiro's mother, Rakia Lawali, has faith that her son will win.
We have nothing to offer him but innovation for him to succeed in life.
Jabiro's participation in the Paris 2024 Paralympics Games will be closely followed by his fans. As a young Nigerian with a disability to engage in sports and compete internationally, Jabiro's achievement is a source of pride for his family and his country. For Borehima Balima in Niamey, Niger, this is Omari Kaseko, VOA Africa.
From sports, we move to politics, where White House officials welcome the rescue of an Israeli hostage held by Hamas Tuesday and said they are finalizing a Gaza ceasefire deal. But even if an agreement is reached, a future U.S. administration will still inherit the problem of managing tensions in the Middle East. White House bureau chief Patsy Widakwaswara looks at potential U.S. policy under Vice President Kamala Harris should she win the November presidential election.
Another deadly Israeli strike on another refugee camp in Gaza as negotiators strive to reach a ceasefire deal in return for the release of Israeli hostages held by Hamas. One of them was rescued on Tuesday. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Welcome home, Farhan al-Qadi. I congratulate the Israeli army in Shin Bet on another successful rescue operation. We are working tirelessly to bring all our hostages back.
That's a message Vice President Kamala Harris also underscored as she accepted her nomination as the Democratic Party's presidential nominee last week.
President Biden and I are working to end this war such that Israel is secure, the hostages are released, the suffering in Gaza ends, and the Palestinian people can realize their right to dignity, security,
Outside of her term as vice president, Harris has no foreign policy background. Her national security advisor is Philip Gordon, who served under Democratic presidents including Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, as well as Joe Biden. This signals a continuity with past Democratic administrations, including on military support for Israel, something her former national security advisor reaffirms. Hallie Seufer is now president of the Jewish Democratic Council of America.
The vice president and the president have supported U.S. military assistance to Israel, not just per the existing agreement that we have with Israel, but also an increase this year because of their security needs.
This despite demands from Arab and Muslim Americans, as well as progressive and young Democrats, for an embargo on arms sales to Israel. At the same time, Harris has expressed more sympathy towards Palestinian suffering than Biden has. Political analyst from Bar-Ilan University, Jonathan Reinhold, via Zoom.
We can't learn a lot from what she says, because what she says now is directed to winning an election and to keeping the Democratic Party together. And since the Democratic Party is divided between those who are more sympathetic to Israel and those who are more sympathetic to the Palestinians about evenly, she has to say basically platitudes. And that's what she's done.
Compared to Biden, who often underscores he is a Zionist, Harris, the daughter of immigrants from Jamaica and India, may be more cognizant of views from the Global South. Middle East expert Natasha Hall at the Center for Strategic and International Studies via Skype.
She is aware of how the rest of the world may feel about the Middle East, about, you know, neocolonialism, neoimperialism. And I really hope that she has the opportunity to bring those experiences to bear if she becomes the president, because that is the reality of what U.S. foreign policy needs to confront the challenges ahead, which are very different from the challenges of the past three decades.
Should she win in November, Harris will inherit the challenges of her predecessors, including a protracted conflict in the Middle East. She will need to formulate her own foreign policy, a high-stakes, complex affair that juggles multiple interests. Patsy Widokuswara, VOA News, Washington.
That's all we had on our menu for you this Wednesday, August 28, 2024. We now take you to Zimbabwe with the song Todi by Oliver Mtukudzi.
Oh, Todi, what shall we do? Sinzijani,
what shall we do?
Been listening to Oliver Mtukudzi and the song Todi. Don't forget to visit www.voaafrica.com for all updates on our programs. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer Kwame Ofori and engineer Saida Hamdun, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
What shall we do?
study.